My name is Ron. I'm an alcoholic. And just to get my wife on edge a little bit tonight, she says, "Oh, you're going to speak tonight. You got invited over to speak." I said, "Yeah." She says, "What are you going to talk about?" And I'm on my way out the door. I said, "Well, I think actually my topic is a sex inventory and sex ideal." And she's like, wait a minute, come back here. If I ever drop that on her, she always gets a little unhinged. I'm happy to be here. I wanted to start by saying this is my home group. Most of you who only come on Tuesday nights don't see me. I'm here typically on Saturday night. I haven't been here probably on a Tuesday night in a couple of years, maybe once or twice in the last 2 years. I've got another commitment that doesn't allow me to be here on Tuesday nights any longer. But I was here as part of the original group that formed this meeting, and I was happy to see Rose tonight because one of the things I was going to mention is when this meeting first started, just to give you some flavor for what the beginnings of this meeting were like, there were, I don't know, Chris, there might have been six of us, I guess, at the most, right, Rose? And we used to sit downstairs, and we'd sit around a table, and we were careful not to call it an AA meeting. Because it wasn't. It was like a workshop of some sort. First workshop, Chris, I could think you'd ever done, right? So, of that nature. So, we were really learning as we go. And we'd sit around this table downstairs, and Chris would read portions of the big book, and then we would share. Everyone was expected to share, so we'd go around the room. And that worked for a while, and then it went from six people to about 10. And then Chris kept the same format. Everyone would go around the room. Then it got to be like 16 people there. We'd go around the room. It was 11:30 at night before we could leave, you know. And we were literally staying there until everyone shared. And then I think what happened was a group, the young people's group from Booton came down. And all of a sudden the meeting doubled and we had to change the format. But at one point we were staying till all hours of the night to have this sort of everybody participate format. But from there, it actually became a meeting. We're actually in the book. And we got like group consciousness stuff and everything. So, but I'm happy to be here and to be a part of that original format, because it did change my life. And this is where I was exposed to and taken through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as outlined in the big book, which is, certainly the experience that's allowed me to be here sharing with you tonight. You know, I was at a retreat this weekend with some folks up in northern Jersey, and there were some out-of-town presenters there from Texas. And when I was driving back from that retreat and then thinking about the fact that I was going to present tonight, it occurred to me that I've told my story many times, and I get into sort of a same story kind of thing. I'm sure nobody else does that. I have a sort of a story down. But one of the things that happened to me in that drive home, and I think it's going to be appropriate for tonight, is it occurred to me so clearly, and maybe this is obvious to everybody else as well, but it just took me 11 years to figure it out. As I was driving home, I was realizing that my story, what happened, what it was like, that part, is my experience of an active first step. You know, we say, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol and our life had become unmanageable. When I was active as an alcoholic, I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. I just wasn't admitting it. All right? I was in actual complete denial. Maybe even unaware. All right? So I was living a first step experience. And if that's the case, maybe the best way to explain my story is to describe it in terms of the first step. So, you know, we say there's three parts to the first step, really. There seems to be two statements, but there's three parts. I'm powerless over alcohol in mind and body. My life is unmanageable on a spiritual basis. So the first step covers a life that includes mind, body, and spirit. We talk a lot about AA. AA is a program of mind, body, and spirit. And if you want to know where that is located, it's in the first step. It's in the powerlessness of mind and body and a spiritual unmanageability. So if those are the three components of a first step, And if an active alcoholic is living a first step experience, here's mine. Okay? I have and have had and still have a physical allergy to alcohol. Okay? When I put alcohol in my body, it's different than other people. And even when I came into AA, I wasn't sure of that for a while. I had to spend some time considering that. Even after my first year, I'd completed all my amends, I came back and I really examined the truth about my being different physically. And there's an important reason why I did that. Because about that time, I was questioning whether or not I was powerless. Okay, there were some questions lingering. And so I had to determine with certainty that I was physically different. And I did an inventory and examined my life and looked at the experiences I'd had and how they were different from the experiences of my friends and family. And there's no doubt that when I put alcohol in my body, I am different than other people, and I have absolutely no control. This allergy creates a craving for more that is absolutely outside of my control. And I'll give you an example of that in my life. I'm going to give you two examples, one kind of early on and then another manifestation later in my life. The first time that I can really think about that being completely true in my life, I played my first varsity football game in high school. So I think I was a sophomore. And we go out into the woods, and a bunch of guys around a big bonfire. It's one of those, like, we'd made a big bonfire that was like 20 feet high. Don't you wonder, how did we ever put those out later? And I don't really know. I mean, like, did we leave it there? I guess, I don't know. So the fire's burning, and everyone had brought something. There might have been like 30 people around this fire, so it's a big bonfire, so it's pretty wide. And people had brought things, and they're passing them around. So there's some pot being passed around. There's bottles of whiskey being passed around. There's bottles of vodka being passed around. Some people had beer. It was sort of like the whole thing was people were passing stuff around. And what happened to me is I started drinking this one particular bottle of whiskey. And I'm trying to remember now the brand of it. It wasn't Chivas. It was. It'll come to me in a minute. But I started to drink this whiskey, and I had it a couple of times. And what happened to me, and I can think of it so clearly now, even though I was only, like, say, 14 at the time, is it began to make its way back around the circle, and I started thinking, I want to get that when it comes back. And I kept watching it. And I'm like, don't be Bogarting that whiskey bottle, right? And when it came back around me the next time, I kept it. I kept that whiskey bottle, because I needed that whiskey bottle. I needed to complete this physical craving, right? And I don't know what the relationship was, because I could have picked anything, I guess, but that was the whiskey bottle. And my buddies, who I still see from high school, kid me about it to this day, because I drank that entire bottle of whiskey, went to a high school dance. Like, that's what we do, right? Like, I couldn't just go home, right? I drink a whole bottle of whiskey and then go to the dance. So I assaulted a teacher. Managed to get thrown off the football team, which I had just made my first varsity team. Got thrown out of school, and then went home and got in a fight with my father. So this was the first time that I'd really experienced the craving of alcohol to that extent, and that was as much trouble as I got in this first big experience at 14. And even though I got thrown off the football team, and thrown out of school, and all this trouble with my parents, I know everybody tells these stories, but it's just true. The next weekend, I managed to find some of those same people, even though I wasn't playing football, and I was drinking again that same next weekend. So there's one example where I put that whiskey in my body, and I started to put it in my body, and I had no control once it was in my body of when I was going to stop, where I would stop, what would happen if I kept drinking. None of those things were within my control at all. At all. Now I jump ahead. You know, I'd managed through a variety of fortunate circumstances after spending a couple years in college largely dealing drugs, and then gotten thrown out and then spent some time traveling across the country, rebounded and ended up with a fairly good career. And I was in a large company, I had just been moved from the sales organization over to the marketing organization. This was probably in the mid-80s, and was sort of like really on the brink of actually having a big career here, right? And I was the key presenter for this. It was a Fortune 500 company. Key presenter for the marketing plans for the year for a couple of hundred people in a presentation down in Dallas. The company was headquartered in Chicago, or down in Dallas for this meeting. I make this presentation and I kill them. It was great. After the meeting, they're all going, "Oh, what a breath of fresh air. Finally, the company's got some life to it. We're moving in a direction that we can understand now. Oh, thank God you're in this position." And I'm like, yeah. And this can only mean one thing, right? So I didn't even really go back to my room. Everybody else went back to their room. The meeting's over because they clean up a little bit. You know, you kind of get organized, get freshened up. That's right. Everybody does. You got to meet a conference. I'll go back to my room a little bit. I went straight to the bar and started drinking. And my idea was, we're in Texas, right? So I said, what could be more Texas than tequila? So I'm starting to drink whatever tequila sunrises or something like that. And I get the bartender to give me a bottle of tequila. He gives me the bottle of tequila, and I get some lemons and some limes or whatever and salt. And now we're going to load up on these buses to go to this dinner. I'm still in my suit and tie. I'm looking good. And I said, you know, I'm going to get this little thing set up in the back of the bus. It's a very mature thing to do. So I get the thing on the back of the bus. There's a little table back there. I have the tequila, a couple of shot glasses and everything. And I'm doing shots with everybody on the back of the bus, celebrating my success. And we get to this place for dinner, and it was just like right out of, what was the one for Travolta, Urban Cowboy? Urban Cowboy. There's like three live bands playing everywhere, and there's pool tables, and, you know, it's great. I think it was called Billy Bob's. It was a great environment for somebody like me. So the next thing you know, I'm drinking. And the women come around, and they've got holsters. And in their holsters are shot glasses, right? And so they can pour the tequila right into their shot glasses. You can drink it. So I'm drinking shots of tequila and then drinking tequila sunrises back. And this is sort of when I'm supposed to really be getting successful in this company, obviously. They found me laying in my own vomit in the bathroom. And a couple of the guys who either were looking out for me or had hoped that, you know, I could stay with the company, said, "Well, let's get him out of here. We'll put him back on the bus." And I could have probably got away and stayed with that company, except for when I got on the bus, they were driving back to the hotel, and I threw up again. Now, anybody who's been on a bus, you know, throwing up on a bus is not a good thing, right? I mean, you can't get away with that. I mean, especially when you throw up on yourself. So, again, I had no choice. There was no control on my part. You know, would it have been okay to have a couple of drinks after that presentation to unwind, like a lot of people would, and just say, "Wow, that was great. I'm going to have a good evening and have a nice meal with my friends." And then that might have been okay. I mean, people can drink, but I can't. Other people can drink, I can't. Because when I put alcohol in my body, I don't know where it's going to take me. I have no control over the outcome. I can't stop it when I want to stop it. I can't turn it on. I can't turn it off. I have no control. And so even in a case like that, I ended up leaving that company, as you might imagine. But I had no control. So I had no control at 14, and I had no control at 38. All right? My ability to have alcohol in my body and control it all, what the outcome would be, does not exist for me. And I believe it does not exist for me today. I don't believe it'll ever exist for me. I am without control over alcohol. I have a physical allergy. Now, in the meantime, I drank and did drugs and was pretty much a wild man. I mean, if that's one example of a businessman, an unconventional businessman at a business meeting, I mean, how conventional is it to get dressed up in your suit and tie in the morning and drop a tab of acid? I mean, that's not normal either, right? So that's the kind of life I was leading, and it was out of control, particularly at a point in time when I was in Chicago and working all kinds of hours. I wasn't seeing my family much at all. I was traveling a lot on business, and I was drinking, you know, every day, all night, and coming home very late and getting up early the next day. The one thing I want to add to my story is one of the things that's important to note that I think that's really important for me to remember is I can tell you a lot about the specific car accidents and all the three total cars I had and, you know, some other experiences, some of even which were funny. I usually tell my the story how I got locked out of my hotel room naked, but well, that'd be for another night. But the important thing that I was thinking about today that's important to my story that I want to remember is one of the things that happened when I was active and I had lost control of my ability to drink normally at all was I put my children in harm's way. And I just say it because it came to me today how many times that happened, either in terms of having them drive with me in the car, or in one case I was actually, I went into a blackout while my kids were home. I was babysitting, my wife was away. And the EMTs had to come, and they came, and then they finally concluded that I wasn't ill, I was drunk, you know. And they left me there, because a neighbor came over. My kids were about 10 and 8. And then shortly after they left, I fell through a window and cut myself, and they were panicked. And it's incidents like that that really remind me that my lack of control doesn't just affect me, it affects others. And it really affected my family, it affected my wife in ways that I'm still practicing amends for. The second part about my story that is so clearly defined for me in step one as an active alcoholic is my obsession. So, you know, you got to ask yourself the question, hey, you got thrown off the football team, you got thrown out of school, you're losing jobs, between 14 and 38, everything is still the same, why would you continue to drink? Why would I continue to drink? And it was happening repeatedly. I could tell you about weddings. We've all had wedding experiences, right? And blackouts. I'd become a kind of a regular blackout drinker. I don't mean going out on a Saturday night and getting blitzed. I mean like Wednesday during the week, you know, a blackout drinker with a big presentation the next morning. So it was like it was a problem. It was a problem. So what drove me back to alcohol time and time and time and time again? And the best description for that I've ever seen was written by Bill Wilson. Now, the doctor wrote quite a bit, in the doctor's opinion, about the different manifestations of obsession. I think he actually lists about five or six different types of obsession that he defines as being associated with alcoholics and for the reasons they come back to drink again and again. But he was a doctor. He wasn't an alcoholic. And Bill Wilson was able to define the obsession for an alcoholic pretty succinctly, pretty clearly and pretty directly. It's on page 30 of the big book, and it's in the chapter More About Alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Now, here's my problem, okay? I already had this sense that I was different, all right? And I know many of you would just find the same thing. Somehow we felt different than other people. I kind of termed that I felt separate from. I wasn't a part of. I was apart from other people. I could be just like anybody else would probably talk about in a room with a lot of people and feel alone. Or be at a cocktail party pretending to make conversation, but not really connecting with anybody. Just drinking. You know, my best connection at a party was, hey, can I get you a drink? Because that brought me right back to the bar, you know? But I didn't feel, the same as other people. I couldn't connect. I felt separate from. So because I felt separate from, and I felt like, that idea that people will find out who I am. And part of that was real. I ended up in a senior position in these companies in marketing and sales. I never graduated from college. I would lie to some of them sometimes, tell them I had an MBA. Later on, that became more difficult. It's like the internet got out there. People can figure those things out, right? But so I always felt like I was going to be figured out. I also really struggled, even I can think back. I didn't think I was a particularly good father. I was married at 21 and had kids right away. Didn't think I was a particularly good husband. And so I was afraid I'd be found out. So I felt different. Okay? So if I already feel different, which I did, the last thing I want to do is say that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Because if I say that, now it's true. Okay? So I don't want to say, wait a minute, I can't drink like other people. Because that would have just been reinforcing the reality that I am separate, that I'm different. I felt that would have stuck out like a sore thumb. Right? So if I'm already feeling like, pick your character defect, you know, or characteristic. Low self-esteem, insecurity. If you have those kind of things, do you want to now admit that you're different than other people? You're already feeling insecure, right? So, I don't want to admit that I'm bodily and mentally different than others. Okay? Therefore, what do I have to do about it? It's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. Now, I needed to do that. Why did I need to do that? Because I needed to define myself as normal. I mean, drinking became a way for me to hopefully reinforce that I'm normal. If I can drink like other normal people, then I'm normal. I'm not different. If I can't drink like other people, then I really am different. So I got to keep trying. So I'd keep trying. So despite my behavior, I'd always include myself for two drinks after work. Right? Even if the night before I'd gotten in a lot of trouble. Even if I'd come home real late. I'm going to try again. I'm only going to stop for two. Okay? And two always led for me with a simple request. Hey, can you call my wife for me and tell her I'm going to be home late? You know? I never want to call myself. So I needed to keep trying to prove that I could drink like other people. I wanted to be normal. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking, this is what Bill Wilson says anyway, is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. So Bill Wilson defines our obsession with alcohol, our powerlessness, our mental powerlessness, as this vain attempt to prove we can drink like other people. And that was my obsession. I kept trying to prove I could drink like other people. What happened? The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. And that's what I was doing. In spite of everything that happened in terms of my kids, in spite of everything that happened in terms of my football team when I was a teenager or my job when I was older, in spite of any of those things, I'd go back and drink again and again and again. Because I wanted to be normal. All right? Now, one of the beautiful things about Alcoholics Anonymous is I am able to come into a fellowship and be with all you people, and that obsession begins to lose its weight, its burden, because I realize I can be at least as normal as you, okay? I don't know how you feel about that. I feel pretty good about it. So I can be as normal as you. I've got a new standard, a new benchmark for my normal, you know, and that takes the edge off. We wonder sometimes, why do we come in here and feel like I'm at ease or I can feel a little bit of relief when I first come into a room full of alcoholics? It's because I don't have to prove my sense of normality to anybody in here. My only way I have to prove I'm normal is by admitting that I'm an alcoholic. That enables me to come here and be as normal as you. So, I have a physical allergy to alcohol. When I put it in my system, I am absolutely without control. And I'm going to go back to alcohol again and again with this belief that I can try and drink like other people. And that's where I have lost the power of choice. So you often hear people say the first step is about losing the power of choice and control. The power of choice is the obsession. I have no choice because of my obsession to go back to alcohol. And I have no control over alcohol once I put it in my system. So I had those clear powerlessness of physical allergy and mental obsession throughout my drinking career. I also had every symptom on page 52 when I was an active alcoholic. We talk about, you know, people coming into the rooms and not doing the work right away and suffering from untreated alcoholism. Think about it. When I'm active, I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism the whole time. And so, you know, how did I feel? We're having trouble with personal relationships. I've already told you about that. I've already told you that I was having a hard time believing that I could be a good husband, believing that I could be a good father. We couldn't control our emotional natures. The only thing I'll say about my emotional nature is I had one key character that anybody who knew me when I was active would attest to, and that was anger. Okay? I was one angry son of a gun. I would punch holes in the wall. I would throw things. I would chase my kids. Sometimes I'd catch them. I just was a very angry guy. And even in business, I'd be angry. I'd take it out on business associates. I'd take it out on my family. I'd take it out on, my parents. My emotional nature was largely tied to this unrelenting anger. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. Well, there's different ways of saying I couldn't make a living, right? When I told you my first story about that bottle of whiskey was being passed around, I wasn't supposed to be making a living then, but I was supposed to be in school, okay? I couldn't stay in school, all right? I ended up getting thrown out of high school. I got back in, but I got thrown out. Ended up having to quit college. Got thrown off the football team. So if you take those kinds of life experiences and you tie them to that statement, I couldn't make a living. I couldn't do the things other people were doing, that they were doing as a normal part of their life. We had a feeling of uselessness. And this is the big one. We were full of fear. All right. Now, if you would have told me that I was afraid when I was an active alcoholic, I'd have probably punched you out. I'm not afraid of anything. I got in here and I found out I was afraid of everything. That self-centered fear was completely ruling my life. All right. I just didn't think I was a good husband. All right. I even want to say it that way now. It sounds a little bit better than telling you the truth, because the truth is I had an incredible level of self-centered fear that I wasn't a good husband. I had an incredible level of self-centered fear that I wasn't a good father. All right? Now, how does that come out? Anger, baby. All right? If I'm afraid I'm not a good father, what would I do about it? I would try to make my kids really, 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 really good kids. And I'd yell at them, get angry at them to make sure that they were really good. That they turned out good. Well, at least by my standards. Now, why would I do that if I have self-centered fear? Because if they turn out good, it's going to prove that I'm not so bad. But if they turn out bad, it's going to prove that my fear is right. I'm a bad father. So all the concerns I had for my kids, I thought it was their concerns for their well-being. It was really concerns for how it made me look. All right? Because I had a tremendous amount of self-centered fear regarding the notion of being a parent. Same self-centered fear regarding the notion of being a husband. All right, angry at my wife, yelled at my wife, screamed at my wife. People who know me now can't believe it. I would wake her up at 5:30 in the morning and say, "My shirt's not ironed. Get up." If you wanted to find an asshole, I was it. And why? Because I wanted to prove that I was really in charge. I went to lunch this week, last week, with another guy in the program whose wife knows us. Knows my wife and I. We go out to dinner occasionally. And he goes, "Oh, yeah, we thought you were coming with us down to this function or whatever." And you ended up not coming. And his wife, her name is Nancy, had said to him, "Well, you know why they didn't come? Donna didn't want to come. That's my wife. And you know who runs that household?" Meaning my wife. And so I had an objection to that. What do you mean? What do you mean my wife runs my household? So I came home and I said, "Hey, Donna, it was implied to me at lunch today that you run the household." She was friggin' hysterical, She's laughing. She goes, "Well, who do you think's been running a house for like 35 years? So, not willing to accept that, I decided I'd check with my kids. Called up one of my kids. Said, "Can you believe somebody suggested that mom really runs the household?" Before I could even finish the statement, meaning that I would really do it, he's hysterical. He's going, "Like, why? You think you had anything to do with it?" So the truth is, I wanted to believe that I was in charge. Because if I was in charge, then I was a good husband, right? The truth was, my self-centered fear was, I didn't know how to be a good husband. I started this thing, experience at 21. How could I know anything, right? Same thing happened to me at work. I told you my education experience and sort of how I treated, I had this huge fear because, as it turned out, I'd get recruited from one job to another. And when they recruited me, especially in the 80s, they wanted you for a particular job. So they weren't like, taking a hard look at your resume. But I had this tremendous fear that if I ever lost a job and really had to go out there and convince people to hire me, my resume would come to light. My lack of education would come to light and I wouldn't be able to get another job. It was a tremendous, tremendous fear. And as a consequence, I worked really hard. I worked every Saturday for like 12 years because I believed that I needed to work harder than the other person because I wasn't as good. So those are some of my fears. Let me just finish this exercise here. We were unhappy and we couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. I think I've convinced you of that, that I wasn't happy and I couldn't be of help to other people. So what happened? So that was my life. I was a full-fledged, living in denial, first step experience guy. I had the allergy, I had the obsession, and I had spiritual inevitability. So how did it end up? Well, what happened was my oldest son ended up in rehab. And long story short, he was sober for a while. And he came home to live with us. We were supposed to have all the alcohol out of the house. We were going to these meetings with their counselors and everything. And we weren't supposed to be drinking in the house because he was coming home to live with us. And the long story short is I could not stay sober. I could not stay not drinking with him in the house. And so I wouldn't drink in the house, but I'd get drunk before I'd get home. I'd be in a blackout. He relapsed. And they decided that they needed to have a meeting down at Carrier to talk about his program. I thought that was a good idea because he'd relapsed, right? We get down there and the meeting quickly lasted on him for like 10 seconds and it turns to me. And they're saying, have you really stopped drinking? Well, no, but aren't we here for him? And then there's two counselors in the room. One of them steps up and stands up and walks across the room to sit down with me. And I'm like, oh, this is bad. And, and they're saying things and, and I'm looking around, I'm getting the lay of the land, my family's there, I'm saying, oh, this is not a good situation. They want me to go straight to rehab from this room. And I'm like, I had the standard line. I have no suitcase. I was sort of in denial about the whole experience. And the one counselor came across, and some of you have heard me tell this story before, but I think it's just appropriate to sort of for the rest of you to hear it. She comes across the woman, and there had been some discussion about whether my son should stay in our house or whether he should go to a halfway house. Okay? So she comes across this circle. She stands right in front of me and she says, I know what you're thinking. And I'm like, F you, you don't know what I'm thinking, And she says, I know what you're thinking right now. You're thinking that if this goes the other way and we simply pull him out of your house and put him in the halfway house, we'll leave you alone. And that might be a good idea. That maybe he should go to a halfway house, take him out of your house, and I can get these people out of my hair, and then I could drink as much as I want. And I swear to you, that's exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking, you know what? If you think I'm such a terrible drinker, take him. Take him. Put him in a halfway house. Now think about what I'm saying, right? I'm saying, take him. I'll trade my son so that I could stay home and drink. And when I realized that that's what she was saying and that's what I was thinking and that's what that meant, I was sick to my stomach. I was just sick to my stomach that I was willing to make that trade. That I'd gotten to the point where I'd be happier with him out of the house so that I could drink. Because I figured, hey, if he went to the halfway house, the counselors aren't going to call the house anymore. They're not going to bother me. So that's what kind of won me over. I was convinced to come here. And the conditions were that I needed to do 90 and 90, or I'd go to a rehab. And I had to check in with my son's counselor every day. It's like my son's counselor is babysitting me. And that was the condition. So I came in here, and I did 90 and 90, and I didn't get a sponsor, and I didn't go through the work, and I didn't last one in, first one out, all that stuff. I didn't want to be here. But after about, about 6 months is when I started coming to this meeting that Rose was at and Chris had started downstairs. And my experience of working the steps were this. I really have no recollection. I'm not saying this is what should happen or does happen, or I'm just telling you what happened to me. I have no recollection at all about the first step, learning anything about it. I have no recollection about the second step. I was at Chris's house when he talked about it, but I don't remember it, didn't remember it. And I had no recollection about the third step. But I do remember this, that I'd realized I couldn't stop drinking by myself. I could not stop drinking by myself. Because I had tried. While my son was in the carrier program, I decided I would stop drinking while he was in there. So I tried to stop drinking on my own. Couldn't do it. Tried to stop drinking for a couple days. Couldn't do it. A week, impossible. I even went to a few AA meetings. Went to an AA meeting in 2 days. I was drinking again. So it had become clear to me that I could not drink, stop drinking on my own. And what also become clear to me is that I was sicker than ever. I was in overwhelming remorse and guilt while I was in the rooms. I was getting sicker and sicker. And so what I do remember, while I don't remember the specifics of going through steps 1, 2, and 3 at all, I do remember at some point realizing I could not stop drinking on my own. And I gave up. I had this moment of surrender. And again, some of you may have heard me say this, but I was at Chris's house. And the reason I don't remember steps 1, 2, and 3 that well is I do remember being at his house, and he was beginning to talk about the fourth step. And I had this sense of surrender where I said, you know what? I'm going to do whatever he says. Nothing else has worked. I can't stop drinking. I'm miserable in AA. I'm miserable drinking. I'm miserable not drinking. My family's screwed up. It's becoming clearer and clearer to me how I was living my life. I'll just do whatever he says. And the reason I remember that is because we were on the fourth step and I started taking a lot of notes. Okay, like, what do you want me to do now? You want me to do the first column first? And then you want me to do what? And then I need to stop after the third column? And then I have to do what? And I'm making all these notes. And so while I don't remember the specifics of the first, second, and third step because it was a blur to me, what I do remember is surrender. You know, so I think, you know, the experience I had was I realized that I had no control over alcohol. I could not do this on my own, and I needed to surrender. And so that was sort of my first, second, and third step experience. And then what happened was I did a fourth step after weeks or maybe even months of procrastinating. And even the day I did it, my family had all left, and they were gone for the weekend, and I was there by myself. And I said, I'm going to start this. It was a Saturday. And I was going to start it Saturday morning. And I'm sharpening pencils, and I'm working on it, you know. It was 1 o'clock before I wrote anything down, you know. I've got to watch the news first. It might rain out, you know. But I had this incredible spiritual awakening as a result of working the fourth step. Because I'll tell you what happened to me. I did the first 3 columns, as I was told. And then what I was told to do is pray for everybody on my list before I filled out the fourth column. And the instructions were to pray for them, asking God how I can show patience, tolerance, and a willingness to be helpful to them. And what happened to me was I also had a notion that I should think about who they were and imagine myself in their life. So I had 32 people or whatever, and so I actually sat and did like 5 minutes of prayer and meditation on each one of them. Prayed for patience and tolerance to be helpful to these people, and had a meditation on what their life was like. And then I proceeded to write the fourth column. And the truth that came out in the fourth column changed my entire life. Changed everything about how I view my life. You know, what is my role? My role was that I was allowing self-centered fear to run my entire life. Okay? I've already told you about my kids. I'm mad at my kids. Why? Oh, because they're going to see lawyers. They're getting thrown out of school. They had the same problems I had. And, they're costing me a lot of money, and their life's going to be terrible. They won't get into a good college, blah, blah, blah. I'm really mad at them. By the time I got to the fourth column, my real concern was they're making me look bad. If all those bad things are happening to them, people might think I'm not a good father. All right? That's the truth. And so my role was I was attempting to manage I was attempting to parent my children not on the basis of what was good for them, but on the basis of what was good for me. All right? And I started to go through the rest of that fourth step and saw that the same thing was true at work. The same thing was true with my wife. The same thing was true with other friends and family. That it was all about, all these resentments were the result of my self-centered fear. And even in the case where maybe they were wrong, my role is that I was judging them. Who was I to judge them? When did I get to the point where I can judge other people? I mean, I just told you a little bit about my life, you know what I mean? And so I realized, wow, if I stop judging them, I can just forgive them. I can just let it be. So I had this four-step experience. I went through my fears, saw completely the truth about my fears, that my fears were all related to the fact of self-reliance. It was all about self-reliance. I did sex harms inventory, and I had an amazing experience. My wife would be happy about this, about my sex ideal, my relationship ideal, that the words in the paper did not match up at all to how I'd imagined my relationship with my wife to be. And instead, it was a life built on mutual respect, mutual love, mutual consideration, and a willingness to put the other person ahead of yourself, which weren't words I would have written normally, right? So I had this incredible four-step experience by being fortunate enough to be put in a place where I could have that guidance to do those steps in exactly that sequence. And actually, the funniest part was, you know, I wasn't even ready to do my fifth step, but I had such my mind was blown with this fourth step that I called Chris up. And I don't know if you remember this, Mary Beth, but Chris wasn't there. And of course, I had like a few months at the time. I thought this was normal. So I said, well, if Chris isn't there, Mary Beth, can I talk to you for half an hour or so? I got to tell you about all this thing. And she listened to me drone on about, and do you realize in the fourth column, there's self-centered fears? And it was amazing to me. And I was able then to do a fifth step and get a measure of relief and freedom from that. The sixth and seventh step on that same day. And actually, we did an eighth step list on that same day as well. And that was around Thanksgiving of 98. By the spring of the following year, I'd completed every amends on my list, including the person I hated the most, who I had told Chris, I'll make this card up. You want me to make a card up? Fine. I'm never going to make amends to this guy. I'll never, ever, ever make amends to this guy. And as it turned out, I hated the guy. As it turned out, I actually met him. I'll tell you what I told him. Because he had done some serious, serious harm to my family. I won't get into all the details of it, but he had really harmed, and he'd actually been prosecuted for it and found guilty. I sat down with him, and I said, my approach to you over the last year, whatever time it was, has been based on two things. Revenge and hatred. And I don't want to live like that anymore. And so I'm not going to treat you with the attitude of revenge and hatred any longer. I am removing that kind of thought from my mind, and I'm going to let go of that. And I don't need to see you again, because I had actually been there's a restraining order because I had tried to prove it to him a little bit differently, you know. And I said, I'm taking away all of those. There's no, you don't have to worry anymore. I have no sense of vengeance or hatred towards you at all. And I've never seen him again. Never seen him again. But I don't hate him. I don't hate him. But I don't have any feelings for him particularly, but I don't hate him, and I don't wish him anything bad for him either. So I was able to finish those amends and move into 11th and 12th step. And within the end of my first year, I was sponsoring a lot of guys at Chris's encouragement. And one of the beautiful things as a result of that experience, particularly going through the amends, where I'd sit down with someone across the table and now really hear what they had to say. And I don't know if any of you have had this experience, but what happened to me frequently is I would say, well, here's what I want to make this amends for. Here's what I remember. And then I'd say, is there anything else you need to tell me? And they had a whole different story, okay? And I've said this one before, too, so some people have heard it. But my oldest son said to me, I told him all these different things that happened. And he said, yeah, I remember all those things. And he wasn't angry, he wasn't bitter, but he simply said, it was like, you know, really profound. He said, all I really remember is you were never there. And he didn't say another word, and I didn't say another word, because I knew exactly what he meant. He didn't mean that I wasn't there physically, because I was a baseball coach, and I would go to the, you know, plays and everything. But what he meant is I was just never there. And the way he said it was perfect. I knew exactly what he meant. And he didn't need to elaborate, and I didn't ask any questions. But that was a learning experience for me. And so I had similar experiences with my mother-in-law and my wife. And my wife was one where, and I share this just for, I guess, for men and women in this room, but it was something that became clear to me and taught me a lot about relationships. When I got ready to do my amends to my wife, I had a big laundry list. I was going to have this big speech. I was going to do all this elaborate stuff, and you know, I had a lot of stuff. And then what became clear to me, the message that came to me in meditation, is everything about our relationship boiled down to one thing. That I had put her in a position, I had tried to put her in a position of being less than. Okay? That was the nature of our relationship. You got an idea? My attitude is, right. You want to tell the kids what to do? I'll change that. Thank you. You want to offer some opinions about our investments? You don't know enough about it. You want to hear about my day at work? You don't understand. And so there is a lifetime of putting her in a position of being less than. And she was overwhelmed by that because she said that's exactly what's happened. And the way she labeled it is she said, you've made me feel small. And I was able to make amends for her. And I tell you, the important thing about that for my relationship is that I know that to be true today. It doesn't mean that I don't fall back into some of those things sometimes. But I know that to be true, number one. And number two, over the last 11 years, she's changed quite a bit, okay? As I told you, she's running a house, and now she's really making it clear, okay? She's got a checkbook. I don't, okay? If I want money, I go to her. And so, our relationship, you know, I guess if she was made to feel less than and the balance was like this, I guess I have to suffer through about 20 years of this, and then we'll get back to being even or something like that. But so I was able to make amends to her and see that with some clarity and get free of that. And because of that, those amends, I was able to, come back to steps two and three. And now look at steps two and three differently and realize what a higher power was doing for me. I really didn't get it as I was going through the steps. But by the time I had gotten to the point where I was sitting across from another person, making amends in a way that taught me that they were every bit as important or more important than I was, it had shifted my sense of self. It had shifted my sense of my self-importance, my self-centeredness. And really, for me anyway, the belief I have is I needed to get through those amends to see not only the nature of my own character defects, the nature of the way I live my life, but also the nature of how I interface with other people. And to get that sort of right size that we talk about. And as a consequence of doing those amends, I was able to come back and find a second and third step experience that was very profound for me as well, given the fact that I came in here an atheist. And not just an atheist, but the most dangerous kind of atheist, like an educated atheist, you know. I'm going to explain to you why there is no God, you know. I used to do it to my poor mother-in-law. She's the sweetest person in the world, you know. Like on Christmas Day, she's in making the turkey in the kitchen. I'm like, you know, there's no God, Mom. I'm telling you right now. And if you believe it, you're weak. You're weak. I just want to get the turkey out, you know. And, you know, so I was an atheist who would talk about it. By the time I'd completed those amends and come back and had a second and third step experience, there was a higher power in my life that had given me a new outlook on life, a new outlook on my spirituality, and a new outlook on the person I was and the person I could be. And so I was able to have that experience with a higher power that I thought I'd never have. And today, I don't feel separate from. You know, I'll come all the way back to my first step experience, right? I used to feel apart from, and now I feel a part of. You know, so the words are almost the same, but there's a pretty big difference, you know. And today I realize sort of what my role in the world is. You know, spirituality to me is defined as not a religious experience, but the way I see spirituality, the way it's been explained to me, the way it's outlined on page 25 in our book, is that it's a change in how I perceive relationships, you know. My perception of relationships has changed. I no longer see the world as a threatening place, a dark place, an angry place. It's a beautiful place. The world we live in is terrific. It's great. It's beautiful. Today the sky was as blue as could be. It was as sunny and as blue as can be. I went out running today, and it was cold, but it looked like a summer day. My relationship with others has changed. And so I realize not that I'm the most important person in the world, that life doesn't revolve around me, but that there is a oneness to the world in which we live in with others. And lastly, I have a relationship with a higher power. So my perception in regards to all those relationships changed. And as that perception changed in each relationship, that is a spiritual awakening. I just woke up, opened my eyes, and I didn't see it the same. The world was threatening, scary, and angry? No. It's beautiful, loving, and wonderful. That's a spiritual awakening. I see things differently. So that's been my experience here in AA, and it all started around that little table downstairs. Rose was there and Chris, and I was able to move from an angry alcoholic. I can't tell you how angry I was. Who was doing a lot of harms and destruction to people around him, to someone who can at least begin to give back a little bit, and to share with other people the value of my experience and to help other people. You know, the last thing I'll say is, I've talked a little bit about the steps. I was also given an opportunity to expand my spiritual life in a way that I never, ever, ever would have imagined, including one of the reasons I don't come here on Tuesday nights is one of the commitments I have is for another spiritual practice. I'm not going to talk a lot about it, but it involves meditation, and it's something I thought I would never do. So it's deepening and broadening my spiritual life. And then in terms of step 12, right now I'm sponsoring 8 guys, and that's basically kind of where I am. One drops in, one drops out. I'm always taking somebody through the steps. Right now I'm taking somebody through the steps. I've got some people doing inventory. I have some people doing amends. I just finished 1, 2, and 3 with another guy. He's writing his inventory. So I try to stay active with continuing to sponsor other men, so that I could provide some of this experience back to them. Not so much to teach them, but to allow them to have their own experience. So I think the most important thing I've said tonight, and Chris has said to me, you know, you might want to end the topic and then open it up for discussion. I think the most important thing to think about tonight for me is talking about the moment of surrender. You know? And it's different for everybody. I mean, maybe somebody had a moment of surrender where they realized their life was, they hit their bottom the day they stopped drinking. I've heard that story. Maybe it's when you did your third step, you know? Maybe it's when, you know, something changed for you. As I told you, for me, it was at Chris's house that day, starting my fourth step was my moment of surrender. But I really believe that without a moment of surrender, without a willingness to drop our resistance, to stop fighting, without that, I don't think we have a chance. We have to find that moment of surrender. That's that moment of where we stop fighting and stop resisting. You know, it's been said to me there's only 2 things you can do in life. You can live in resistance or you can live in surrender. Okay? There's only 2. And you can't be on the line. And if you want to know what they are, they're very easy to figure out. I'm worried. Resistance. Okay? I'm angry. Resistance. I'm anxious. Resistance. Why are those all resistance? Because it's just like saying, I'm angry. God, I didn't get somebody I want, something I wanted. I'm anxious. I'm worried that God's not going to give me what I want. I'm afraid. God, are you really going to do it or not? You know? But if I'm in surrender, there's only 4 things that are happening in my life. Acceptance, gratitude, compassion, and forgiveness. And so if that's active, then I'm in surrender. You know? And it's also been pointed out to me that when we say God is everything or he's nothing, it's not an intellectual question. You don't just say yes or no. You check your state of being. Am I in surrender or am I in resistance? Because if I say, oh, absolutely, God's in charge of my life, but I'm worried about everything. I don't have any money left. I'm angry at my wife. And, you know, my kids are really pissing me off. And, no, God's running my life. You know, doesn't work like that, you know. So I just need to check, you know, if I want to know if God is everything or is everything or he's nothing, I need to check the state of my being. And I need to check and see if I'm in surrender or resistance. But the topic might be, if anybody else wants to add anything when I close, is that moment of surrender. Thanks for letting me share tonight.